It is time for the Media Beat with David Terechuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. We broadcast on the weekend and also next week during our noontime hour. You can also find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be with you. And it's especially good for me as a practitioner in the media to be talking to you through the medium of independent, non-commercial local radio. This is the time when local radio comes into its best mode, and its most needed mode, and its most required mode, and the mode at which it is best. In some ways, much better than many other modes of communication. There's nothing like a major crisis to bring out the need for local radio more clearly.
It's like I said, I've been in this a long time, and I've never felt the burden of having to provide a service more than we feel right now. I mean, yesterday, basically, and David, you'll understand this, being in the media, all hell broke loose in between 11 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock in the afternoon. We managed to keep up with it, and other radio stations, local radio stations, managed to keep up with it, and we'll have to do this on a daily basis. You know, we all have to face this new way of life, which people in, you know, we should be lucky by doing this in advance. Well, we got a late start, so who knows whether or not we caught it in time. But we don't want to have a lock. Look at Italy, and that's the reason why we're doing what we're doing. We don't want to wind up like what happened in Italy.
Sure, we can hope for the best, but while hoping for the best, we need to prepare for the worst, yeah. And that's what's happening. All the closures being announced, all the cancellations, which it's your responsibility as a broadcaster locally to keep your audience informed of. Those are the things that are going to work as what the medical community calls prophylactic way. Put it more simply, just the preventive way. We're all in the prevention business now. It's not a matter of hysteria. It's not a matter of overreaction. It's a matter of, you know, we could all make a decision, if we're sensible, to act in the best interests of preventing ourselves and our fellow citizens falling victim to what is now quite clearly, and there's no argument about this anymore, or there can't be in any logic, it is a pandemic. It exists all over the world, pretty much. And there are ways of preventing its spread. You can't do anything about the people who have already contracted it except isolate and apply what forms of treatment that do help, although, as we know, there is no actual cure. But what we can do, and we have a very strong responsibility to do, is prevent the spread.
And that's what all these rules that are being put in place are about, is keeping people apart. One of the biggest problems they faced in Italy was, and the younger generation just did not listen to the initial rules and congregated in large numbers at large events, and the virus spread like wildfire. What, by closing schools, by putting all these things in action, you're trying to separate the public. And yes, it's a hardship on everybody, but that hardship hopefully will pay off in the end with us not having thousands of deaths.
Exactly. What's the greater hardship? Missing a ball game or having thousands of people die? Absolutely.
You know, I wonder what people... What people nowadays, the younger generation, and I'm on the cusp of that, but would have done in World War II, or thinking about the people in England during the war and the bombings. I mean, this is a war, and it's not a war against another country. This is, in all intents and purposes, David, a war against a virus.
Yeah, it's a war, and it requires, to some degree at least, the exertion of wartime conditions and wartime emergency measures. One of the problems about that as an image, as a kind of imagery, and a metaphoric way of talking, of course, is that it can be taken too literally. Yeah. Some of the current federal administration's terms are borrowed from that playbook, that military playbook. And like it often is at times of great stress. When, for instance, we talked a lot, and people are mercifully talking less this way now, but we have in the past talked a lot about the war on drugs, for instance, in the same way that we would have talked about the war on poverty. It's best not to take it too literally. Two simple things: you can't shoot a virus, and you can't deport a virus. These are some of the realities about this kind of war that we have to accept. And the measures that we have to take, as you say, are preventive, and they are about social distancing and all sorts of things that are just awkward for us to take to. It's disruptive, as if we don't have enough disruption in our life already. But it's a disruption that is absolutely worth it for the sake of keeping the death rate down, the potential death rate down. And yes, Italy had a poor enactment of what emergency notions they needed to put in place. They weren't observed, and it stresses the importance of taking the measures and observing the measures. If we're members of the public, let's be considerate of our fellow citizens and caring about them, as well as convinced that we individuals, as perfectly healthy individuals, can go amongst the crowd and be okay. Well, most of us probably can, but many of us can't, and it's the more vulnerable who are in the front rank of putting up those numbers to potentially to the same sort of level that happens with influenza, and we don't want that replicated. And the best way of ensuring that it isn't replicated is to take all the emergency measures that have been shown to work. It's worked in China, and they were slow on the uptake initially there, in the province where it started, but now it looks like the disease is is leveling off, and that's for a bit. How long it will take is unknown, but it could be within a matter of weeks. Preventing the spread is the key right now, and the communications media have that an awesome responsibility, it seems to me now. You mentioned it as a burden a moment ago. It's certainly a weighty responsibility, but it's one that I think journalists and communicators in general need to welcome enthusiastically. Because this is what brings out the best in this profession of ours.
And this is, you know what? This is one of the, this is the main reason that all of us who get into the broadcast or news industry, why we get into it. Because this is where we show our most unbelievable resilient value in keeping people calm and keeping people informed, and also just having a friendly voice on the radio that somebody who might be alone and shut in can go to each day. It's a very big responsibility, and this is a time where either we shine or we don't. Plain and simple.
Yeah, much of the media is, if not shining, at least doing a fairly decent job at the moment. Some not. Some are falling prey to the notion that it's a war of a different kind. It's a political war of opposing beliefs. It's not. We're dealing with facts here, and yet, nonetheless, you still see pockets of the media behaving as if it's some kind of battle for advantage between different sets of beliefs, and that it, one side is saying that the other side is promulgating a hoax. That's the sort of language which doesn't help at all. But it's a sign of our times, I'm afraid, that the main responsibility of the media, which I think you put rather well, which is to keep people informed, and if and at times of a lack of calm, offering the prospect of calm, doing some active calming of people's fears, keeping fears in proportion, for instance. We have some justification for fear. There is a pandemic at work, and it is hard to control, but it is controllable. All pandemics, generally speaking, are. And it's the media's responsibility to take on that role enthusiastically and in a way that is level-headed. And not indulge in political backstabbing and name calling and finger pointing.
And nothing can be more.
Keep a careful sense of who is acting responsibility and call out those people who are not behaving responsibility.
And nothing points it out more than, and I point this out, when this all first started, our president called it a hoax. Well, he very learned, not quick enough, but he learned that it's not a hoax. And his broadcast, while it was more tempered towards businesses and not really soothing towards American, showed it. But then when you see now pictures of world leaders, the Canadian prime minister's wife was exposed, the president and vice president at Mar-a-Lago exposed potentially to this virus by a delegation that was there. It brings it all more into focus that this is not one side against another. This is something that can affect anybody at any time. And it doesn't mean if you're exposed to it that you're going to get it, but it means that you have a better chance of getting it. And that's why less contact with people, the better.
Yeah, and the reality, some of the realities we have to face are very dispiriting realities, but they have to be accepted because they are realities. For instance, the the very poor performance by this country, one of the world's leaders in terms of technology, and the almost incomprehensible lack of testing kits for all Americans. I mean, the president was ill-informed enough to say at one point that everyone needs to be tested can get tested. That simply isn't true. And the fact that it's what's dispiriting things about the American federal reaction to this crisis, the fact that we don't have enough kits, the first kits that were made were not in accordance with international standard because we decided to go our own way. Does this sound familiar, perhaps? America wants to be not part of a multinational decided to go its own way in making its own kits, and then they were discovered before, and now there simply aren't enough of them, and it's not very clear. In fact, despite a lot of journalistic effort to find this out, it's not really clear why they're not being produced in the numbers they need to be produced now, and not reaching all the places in the country where they are needed. It's extraordinary. It's not often you get in journalism moments like this, but we had a very clear message, which journalists are very duty bound to report. But the head of the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, saying in so many words, and this is a journalistic question, is going to stay and become historical. Now, a matter of historical fact, and he said the system, he's talking about this, the system is not really geared to what we need right now. That is a failing. Let's admit it. And that is in stark contrast with our president reading from a teleprompter and telling us that everyone who can have a who needs a test can have a test. We need consistency of messaging, and we need the inconsistencies pointed out by journalists in a a responsible way, and we need the truth, you know, asserted more clearly and established more fully and confidently in the population at large, because this is the only way we're going to defeat a spreading epidemic, now a pandemic. People need to keep their heads, but they need to keep their heads filled with well-based facts and information.
You know, it's, you know, I go back to the fireside chats of Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the war. I think what every president needs to do in a time like this is to reassure the population with updates via TV and radio and whatever, and talk directly to people about the human element. And here's what I wish they would do is, yes, there's going to be an economic factor because of this, of what's happening. But separate that out. Have the Treasury Department, have your people, your business people, talk about it in a different forum for businesses and people to hear. When the president speaks, people want to hear reassurance, and they want to hear everything from the president that gives them the confidence to go on comfortably. So I hope the White House ends up doing that in the future. When the president speaks, just speak to the people about what's going on truthfully and honestly, and make them feel like the government knows what's going on. And then for the business side of it, handle it at a different press conference, because they're two different things, and the majority of the 323 million people in this country want to be reassured by the President of the United States that the United States is doing all it can do at the current time.
Well, presidents in the past, various times, have been called great communicators when they're good at that particular task of taking the nation into their confidence, and instilling confidence in the population. This president doesn't seem well suited for that. The 10 minutes of the address to the nation from the Oval Office was replete with errors, factual errors, and I think you're right. It was, I suspect, along with you, geared towards economic reassurance rather than any kind of human reassurance. But it, just in terms of sheer communication ability and confidence, it was shockingly poor. The man had seemed to have a hard time reading English words, it was a remarkable exercise in slapdash communication. It was done very fast, we know that, and it was done predominantly by two individuals, the president's son-in-law and his advisor, Stephen Miller, and they must take responsibility for a piece of national communication to the entire population, aimed at the entire population of the United States, which was, as I say, replete with errors and tonally totally off beam for what was needed. And we saw its result in the economic field, apart from anywhere else. The attempt was being made to reassure the markets more than anything else. And the markets were the first to respond almost in real time, minute by minute, as those 10 minutes rolled out. And the president struggled to enunciate these not very difficult words, but seemed very difficult for him to say. By each minute, the financial markets were dropping. And of course, that was only a prelude to what happened the following morning, when in the United States, the daytime markets opened, and there was the worst drop in those markets, Black Monday in 2007, at the height of the beginning, the terrible crash of 2007 and 2008. So we do not have in the president what we would call a great communicator, even though he may have made his reputation as a television star. You may wish for that kind of firm hand on the tiller, being exerted from the Oval Office, but I fear it's not going to happen. It's going to have to be the communications apparatus in general of government in this country that does it, enabled, of course, by the more responsible elements of our independent media. I don't think we can look to and expect, at least, we can't realistically expect the kind of leadership you're talking, communicative leadership that you're talking about from this presidency, I'm afraid.
Now, let's talk about this in the world scope. You know, the United States used to be, in crises like these, a beacon where the rest of the world can turn to. And that's not the case. And as a matter of fact, as with the no-fly from Europe, our allies were caught by surprise by this. Our embassies were caught by surprise by this. Our Americans living abroad were caught like this, and foreign powers were caught by surprise. We really do need to reintegrate on a lot of different levels, so we are once again part of the worldwide community.
Sure, and that goes, yeah, absolutely. That goes, you know, back to the core of what was made so evident by that 10-minute address to the nation from the Oval Office. If the best you can do is to talk to your country about a foreign virus, that was the term used by the President of the United States. And of course, you can't expect to be taken seriously in the world at large. Viruses are neither one nationality nor another. They're neither of those things. They are a virus. Like I said before, you can't deport them and you can't execute them. But the role of America in the world has never been shown quite so clearly in its falling off, its transformation from being a world leader to being almost a joke figure in the international landscape now. Uncle Sam doesn't carry any of the serious authority in this international crisis that we're in. That role has gone to who knows. There's no one in charge. There's no one exerting that power that you mentioned of being a beacon of responsibility and leadership. It's not there. We don't see America in its historic role here. It may have been an exaggerated role in history. We may be fooling ourselves to think that we were influential, generally speaking, particularly in supporting democracy around the world. That may not be as dewy-eyed as people have been about it in the past. But we swung very much to the opposite corner now. We're in the dark. No one looks to us for bright leadership anymore, I'm afraid. We're a dark corner of the world.
And, you know, when you compare this, China has stepped in to fill that void business-wise in the world. But when you look at an outbreak like this, China is silent. The Soviet Union, Russia is silent. There is nobody that can stand in and take that place and say, hey, listen, this is the direction we have to go. I mean, Germany and Europe are trying, but once again, it's without the cooperation of one of the biggest democracies in the world, it doesn't go that easy to make the world seem at ease.
Yeah, just the simple fact that we don't have the kits to test people. Testing whether or not people have this virus is, of course, absolutely crucial. It's central to preventing its spread. And other countries have managed to get ahead of the disease in some degree. There are some places where, in South Korea, for instance, they're testing 15,000 people a day. And they, like us now, belatedly, we're slowly catching up with this. But South Korea was the first to implement drive-in testing and get a grip on it that way. And they seem, in general terms, to be getting a grip on the disease. And it's not moving as rapidly as it was before. China, not a good example for us. I don't think we'd want to emulate their ways of exerting population control. But it looks now as if it were over the worst in China. It does seem that their very, very repressive measures, which you can do as a totalitarian regime, are proving effective. And it may well be that the China's greatest worry from now is right. For the rest of the world of the society of China.
All right, David. Well, stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely.
David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio.